Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Solomon, the most interesting man in the world, to me. Probably my favorite character in all of the Bible. I know everybody's like, what about Jesus? But we've already put that to rest. Jesus is supreme above everybody else, but there's just something about Solomon that has always captivated me. You know, this is a guy that, like the Houston Texans, he starts well, but he doesn't finish. You know what I'm talking about. Hello, 24-0, right? I wasn't even watching the game, people. Wasn't even watching the game. And I'm busy, and I turn on the radio, and I'm driving to somebody that's like, this is insane. It's 24-0, Texans. And I was like, what is going on? And then I turn it back on a little bit later, and it's like, 51-24. You know, what happened, right? Well, it didn't end. That was 51-31, right? Wasn't that the final? 51. You get outscored 51-7 after you're up. Anyway, so Solomon, back to that guy, he seems to start really well. Really well. I mean, how many of you would love to have a vision from God where God appears to you? God appears to you and talks to you and says, I'll give you anything in the world. I'm still waiting for that. I'm still waiting for that. And as I do this study of Solomon, I was like, anytime, anytime. You just show up in my bedroom and say, Jeremy, I'll give you anything. What do you want? And you know what I'm going to ask for? What did Solomon ask for? Wisdom. I'm going to ask for money. I'm kidding. I'm messing. I'm just making sure y'all are paying attention out there, right? What you saw from Solomon was he asked for wisdom, and then, of course, God gives him everything else, right? He gives him wealth. But here's the thing I want us to get for today, because it's going so well. For 2 weeks, this has gone well. Today, it's going to keep going well. Next week, not so much. Not so much. Remember, he is a member of the Houston Texans. He is. And that one of the things that we're going to see is he's a little bit different from his daddy, David. It's not that his dad didn't make mistakes. He made some huge ones, right? But there's something really different about David and Solomon. And here's the thing. I'm not going to tell you what it is until next week. See there? See, now you got to show up. Before I get into some things that I want to show you today from 1 Kings chapter 8, there's a little bit of background I want to give you. Solomon, David was not given permission to build the temple, but Solomon was. And what he built was pretty magnificent. It was pretty magnificent. It took, according to scholars, 150,000 laborers, about 7 to 8 years to build this thing. 150,000 laborers to build this thing over a period of, 7 to 8 years, give or take. A lot of it was layered in gold. 1 Kings tells us that Solomon used more than 4,000 tons of gold to build this. He uses more than 40,000 tons of silver to build this thing. That, my friends, is impressive. Do you think that it was shiny a touch? My guess is yes. The price of what he used in today's value, some scholars, you adjust for inflation, of course. Some scholars have said that this could have been as much in today's values of $150 to $160 trillion. That, my friends, is some cash. Trillion. One scholar even said that the amount of gold that Solomon used in the temple, just the temple, was about 5% of all of the gold that had ever been mined on the earth. 5% went into one spot, one building. That is incredible. And that doesn't include the fact that on the walls, there was jewelry everywhere. So this thing was worth some serious cash. Is that fair enough? The other thing is that the whole point in the building of this was to give a centralized place for the nations to worship God. That was it. It wasn't so that you just had this thing that was there that was so catching to the eye, or somebody even say, so wasteful of natural resources, because that could have been, you could have, how many compassion children could you sponsor with $150 trillion? It's a lot. It wasn't even about that. It was to give it a place, a centralized place, where the worship of God was to take place. And this is some things we're going to see as we look into 1 Kings chapter 8. Some of the wisdom of Solomon, because he had it in spades. He was such an impressive guy that you even have the Queen of Sheba saying, I have to come and meet this man. And for all of the expectations that she had, which frankly were pretty high, he blew her away. absolutely blew her away. She walks away and says, you are greater than even the stories about you. So what are some of the things that Solomon can teach us? What are some of the little bits of wisdom that we can kind of put into ourselves today, and then we can walk away and say, this is the keeper stuff. This is the part that's worth taking home. And that brings me to the first point. And I have this picture of Solomon's temple just to kind of give you an idea of it. But this is the first point that I want you to get for today. And it's this. There is a thing about God, and it's that God is knowable, but there's also parts of God that we just don't know. God is knowable, but also God is, in some senses, unknowable. So we had this picture, right, of the temple. And at this time, they're bringing the Ark of the Covenant, right? Everybody has pictures of Harrison Ford now in their head, and Indiana Jones, right? And for somewhere out in Area 51, there it is in a box that's somewhat singed on the sides, because you remember the end of the movie, right? There it is out there somewhere. But they're bringing the Ark of the Covenant in, and the innermost court of what you saw in the temple was called the Holy of Holies. And this was the place, this is where the Ark of the Covenant, which contained the very presence of God, dwelt. It was closed off by a veil. The veil was 4 inches thick, incredibly heavy. The veil is known as the parakeet. So the veil is there. But the word parakeet, this that describes the veil, literally means shut off. That's what it means. And it gives us this picture. This is what the veil does. It gives us this symbol. It shuts off the presence of God from everyone. And what it gives us is this picture that this is exactly what our sin does. It shuts us off from the experience of the presence of God. You fast forward to Jesus. Let's go forward to Jesus. When Jesus dies on the cross, some of you would probably remember this from the Gospels, the veil is torn in two. And this, of course, this is symbolic of his body being torn so that the way to the presence of God is open. It's open. And we see this, by the way. The significance of this point that I'm trying to make, that there's an aspect of God that is knowable and there are aspects of God that are unknowable, you even see this in 1 Kings 8, starting in verse 10. Here's what it says. When the religious leaders came from the holy place, the cloud filled the house of the Lord. So the religious leaders were not able to stand there to do their work because of the cloud. Then Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he would live in the thick cloud. I have built you an honored house, a place for you to live forever." Did you catch that? This guy named David Guzik, he said, the extreme presence of the glory of God made normal service impossible. The extreme presence of the glory of God made normal service impossible. The sense of the presence of God was so intense that the priests felt it was impossible to continue in the building. Now think about that for a second. Because we have this idea that God is our friend, and I'm not trying to take that away this morning. I think there's a sense in which that is true. But let's don't kid ourselves. We have relationships with humans that we don't treat the same as other relationships. It's just true. For example, if the President of the United States were making an appearance here today, right, there is something about the office of the President of the United States that we're supposed to respect, regardless of who's holding the office. There's something about the office that we're supposed to respect, and something about the person that holds the office that we're supposed to respect. There's something about the gravity of the office. We're supposed to be praying for this person. It doesn't matter who it is. Pray for this person, right? That God would give them wisdom, that they would follow God, and they'd be a blessing to the people, like Solomon was a blessing to his people. But think about that. Would you approach the President of the United States a touch differently than maybe the way that you would approach me? And we're just talking people, right? I'm just a guy. The President, whoever the President is, you might just say, well, it's just a guy. Actually, you go, no, not just a guy. It's the President of the United States, and it makes it a little bit different. Well, imagine that you're talking about approaching God, right? We're kicking it up a notch. A little bit, to say the least. We're kicking it up a notch. And it shows us something in these verses of what happens when you really have an experience of God. There is something about it that is at times overwhelming, overpowering. It got even to the priests to the point they said, we're not able to do our work because the presence of God is so thick. in this place. We know that God is good. We know that God is love. Why should an intense presence of goodness and love make the priests feel that they couldn't continue? And the answer is because God is not just goodness and love. God is holy. And they were experiencing the holiness of God. And by the way, in experiencing that, they were getting a pretty good idea of who they were. I don't deserve to be here. And it overpowered them. It overwhelmed them. If we're constantly walking around feeling that we deserve to be in the presence of God, or if we're constantly walking around feeling that, you know, God is my friend, God's just my buddy, we might have lost this sense of what it means to really experience God. God isn't just goodness and love, God is, but God is holy. And when we experience that, we have a real sense of who we are. We're not. We're not. And He is. So the intense sense of the presence of a holy God, by the way, this here, and even in the New, not warm and fuzzy. It is not warm and fuzzy, which is a lot of times is what we're looking for in our relationship with God. Men like Peter, if you look at Luke chapter 5. Isaiah, when Isaiah has, we love this part in Isaiah and Isaiah 6, you know, where God says, "Whom shall I send?" And Isaiah says, "Here I am, send me," right? And it sounds like this great moment where you go, rising up, right, to lead the people of God and so forth. But have you ever noticed in the same passage in Isaiah chapter 6, they get a hint of the presence of God. And what do? They're overwhelmed with the holiness of God when they just get a hint of the presence of God. And they see themselves as unworthy. I don't deserve to do this. I don't deserve to be in the presence of God. They were feeling it here in 1 Kings 8. I don't deserve it. They felt, frankly, they felt stricken. This wasn't because God forced an uncomfortable feeling on them, but because they simply could not be comfortable sensing the difference between them and God. And it was pretty stark. Question, simple question first. When is the last time that you felt that in your relationship with God? You felt that. I was thinking about it this week. I came to Jesus when I was 11 years old. That was when I accepted Jesus. And I remember I could take you to the church, to the seat that I was sitting. I can take you there. 11 years old. And it was the first time in my hard-headed life that I remember sitting there and saying, "I don't deserve what He's offering me. I don't deserve it." And it overwhelmed me. But I also had this other thought. I don't deserve it, but I need it. I need it. God is good and God is love. God is also holy. And that shows us the second point for this morning. How you approach God and how I approach God really matters. How we approach God really, really matters. Think about it like this. Look at verse 22. It says this, Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord, and in front of all the people of Israel, he lifted his hands toward heaven, and he said, "O Lord God of Israel, there's no God like you in heaven above or on earth below. You are keeping your agreement and are showing loving kindness to your servants who walk in your ways with all of their heart." A couple of things if you want to, if you're markers in your Bible kind of people, they follow God with all of their heart. All of their heart. There's no leftovers. There's no leftovers. It's the whole thing. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? That's what you see in the New Testament. By the way, there's nothing left of you. That's it. There's nothing left of you. But here you see Solomon. I want you to think about it. This was the most common posture for prayer in the Old Testament. We typically think of prayer as, kind of like this, right? Or we have prayer rails, and people can go and they can kneel, and that's perfectly fine. In the Old Testament, the most common posture of prayer was what he was doing here, and it's that they would raise their hands up to God. They would look up to God, and the reason that they would do it is it was symbolic. It was them telling God, "I want you to look all the way down through me. Look all the way down. I'm open. I'm open. Just tell me what it is that you see when you look in there, and tell me what parts of me need to go." You know, a lot of us, we close our eyes, we bow our head, we fold our hands. That just wasn't what he did. In the Old Testament, the tradition was to spread the hands toward heaven in a gesture, and the gesture said this: I am surrendered, I am open, I'm receiving. I'm taking it. I'm taking it. So it shows us how it is that we're supposed to approach God. Solomon gives us some sort of hint of how we're supposed to approach God. One, you realize that you're approaching a holy God. And so you might have this sense that when you really encounter God, you're going to feel like these guys, a little stricken, a little stricken. But also, because of who it is that you're approaching, you take it with seriousness. You take it with seriousness and openness to say, show me what you see. Just show me what you see. Third thing that I love about Solomon from this passage that you see in the 8th chapter, did you notice he builds the temple? God is in the temple, but God's not only in the temple. God's in the temple, but he's not only in the temple. Let me make some sense out of this really, really fast. If you look in verse 27, it says, but is it true that God will live on earth? See, heaven and the highest heaven are not big enough to hold you. How much less this house which I have built. But keep in mind the prayer of your servant, O Lord my God, listen to the cry and to the prayer which your servants pray to you today. Open your eyes night and day toward this house, toward the place which you have said, my name will be there. Listen to the prayer your servant will pray toward this place. By the way, even today, Jews, if they're scattered around the world, one of the things that they will do as a matter of their prayer is they face the Temple Mount. And it's because of a passage like this. You face toward this place. God was doing something special as he builds the temple on this place. God was doing something. And he goes on in verse 30, listen to the prayer of your servant and of your people Israel. And when they prayed toward this place, hear in heaven where you live, hear and forgive. Notice what I said. God is in the temple, but not limited to the temple. Notice what he said in verse 27. How much less this house which I have built. Nothing can contain you. How much less this spot? How much less this spot? By the way, we're talking $150 trillion spot. Right? How much less this? How much less? On the one hand, Solomon says he built God a house to dwell in. We might have thought that he drifted toward the idea that God actually lived in the temple to the exclusion of other places. It's important to recognize that though God had a special presence in the temple, he's too great to be restricted to the temple. He had a special presence in the temple, but his presence is too great to be restricted to the temple. Remember, the whole idea of the temple was what? Is that it would be a gathering place for the nations, not just a subset of people, but for everybody. And so what that means, you even see this from God, there's a special place that I'm going to dwell. Here it's in the temple. Today it's meant to be in you. Today it's meant to be in you. There's a special place that I want to dwell, but it's not going to be at the exclusion of other places. There's a special place I want to dwell. And it's in you. And what this shows us is number four, God's desire is to forgive and to restore everybody. That is God's desire, to restore and to forgive everybody. It actually goes in this order, forgive and then you're restored. Restoration, by the way, can be a little bit of a process. Heads up. Restoration can be a little bit of a process. But there's something I want you to keep in mind. You see this in verse 46 of chapter 8, and it says it very simply, there is no one who does not sin. You catch it in verse 46. There is no one who does not sin. Why build the temple? You know, it's going to be a place for God to dwell. No, why really are we building the temple? And the answer is because people have a problem with worship. That's why. We have a problem with worship. I think it was John Piper once said, we have missions because we have a worship problem. If worship was happening everywhere, we wouldn't need missions. Worship isn't happening most places, and so we have missions. That's why we have it. We have a worship problem. We tend to worship things rather than God. God's desire is first to forgive and then second to restore. Why? Verse 46, there's no one who doesn't sin. None. I can think of one person that I've actually met that when I was in engaging them, this was on the streets of New Orleans, right? After Hurricane Harvey, I remember having this conversation with Rob. We'd really gotten to have a great relationship with Rob. He is the only person that I've ever met that said, I've never sinned. He is it. I have never met anybody else. And I got to tell you, I was sitting there on the streets of New Orleans, and I said, guys, this is my lucky day. This is my lucky day. Because I now know of two people that have lived perfect lives, Jesus and Rob. And I think Rob was sitting there on the street, and after a moment, you know, he was like, okay, yeah, I can't get away with that one. The problem isn't really just common. The problem is universal. That's what God's trying to tell us today. Remind me, there was a Sunday school teacher. You know Sunday school lessons, you ask questions, and then you just pause because you never know what's going to happen with children, right? You never know what's going to happen with children. And there was a Sunday school teacher that was asking the question, you know, okay, so, you know, kids, can anybody tell me what you have to do before you can obtain the forgiveness of sins? And there was a little boy named Johnny that was sitting out there, and he goes, sin. Well, true, right? I mean, Johnny was locked in that day, everybody. I don't think that's really what the teacher was asking. What is it that you have to do before you can obtain the forgiveness of sins? Sin! Well, Johnny gives a ringing endorsement that morning, right? And everybody walks out, and they sins greatly, right? Well, I want you to think about this. Since the problem is universal, the need is universal. Since the problem is everywhere, the need is everywhere. You even see this in verses 41 through 43. Just take a look real fast. It says, when a stranger who is not of your people Israel, when a stranger. By the way, I mean, imagine it being somebody that you don't like very much. Or imagine it being a person that is not of Israel, and frankly, they don't like Israel. Which, frankly, there were a lot of them back then, like pretty much everybody. Think about it. When a stranger who is not of your people Israel comes from a far country because of you, for they will hear of your great name and your powerful hand and your long arm, when he comes and prays toward this house here in heaven where you are, do all the stranger asks of you, so that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you as do your people Israel, and then they may know that this house I have built is called by your name. The temple was in Israel, but it was always intended to be a house of prayer for all nations. Isaiah tells us this in Isaiah 56. God wants the court of the Gentiles, by the way. Remember, it's kind of divided up a little bit. God wanted the court of the Gentiles to be a place where the nations could come and pray. Go to the New Testament. Think about this for a minute. I'm building a place where people can come find me. And what is the number one obstacle to people finding me is people. It's people. And you see this. Jesus gets really ticked. We always love this picture of gentle Jesus, meek and mild. And I'm like, no, keep reading. Keep reading. When he came to the temple and he found the outer courts, the only place where the Gentile nations could come and pray, notice what he found. It was more like a swap meet than a house of prayer. That's what it was. And he drives out the money changers. He drives out the merchants because this is my place. This is my place. And look at what you've done with it. The number one obstacle to people finding Jesus are people. It's people. Here, what do you think? Making the place where they're supposed to find him, a place where they could have never found him if they wanted to. By the way, do our churches do that? I'm just saying. So in honor of this, next week, I'm going to drive the money changers out in the atrium. I'm just kidding. Jesus takes it pretty seriously. You want to know why? It's because eternity is on the line. And you don't play with that. You don't play with that. I was in a conversation with one of my agnostic friends this last week, and I said, can we agree? There was so much we weren't agreeing on, everybody. Does that surprise you? It doesn't surprise either of us. We're just really close. And I said, hey, look, I want to ask you a question. Can we agree, in spite of all of our disagreements right now, that if God exists, it changes everything? Can we agree that if God exists, it changes everything? He sat there for a second. He goes, yeah, that's a game changer. That's a game changer. I said, absolutely. And what I don't want to do in my relationships with people is to do something that gets in the way of them knowing him. That's it. That would be the kinds of speech that I have, the way that I treat them, the way that I treat people. By the way, back then, Jesus gets ticked because of the way that people are getting treated. And more or less, what is he saying? You know better. You know better than this. As a church, can I just encourage us this morning to remember this passage so that we keep our eye on the ball? Can I just say that? Let's keep our eye on the ball. One of the things I love about us, we're a very missional church. I love that about our church. Let's keep our eye on the ball. I was thinking about this week. I go back to being 11 years old. I just kept going back to being 11, and I just remember giving myself to Jesus. And by the way, my walk with Jesus is fits and starts, okay? There are times where it's like, hey, we're looking all right now, and then other times I'm like, did I ever really choose Jesus to begin with? Do you have those moments in your life? You know, it's fits and starts. Remember this, Jesus says, it's the sick who need a doctor. We ask a very simple question, who's sick? And he's saying, yeah, it's all of you. It's all of you. He's the doctor. There's no lack. There's no lack of offer from Jesus' hand today. There's no lack of that. What we have to get over sometimes is we have to get over our sense that, you know, I'm undeserving of it. I already knew that when I came to Jesus to begin with. I didn't deserve it. He just said, I want you to have it. I want you to have it. What else could he do in his love than to say, I see the brokenness and I just want to put you back together? What else can he do? It reminded me, there was a story some years ago. This one totally cracked me up when I ran into it. There was a Spanish story of a father and a son. They had become estranged. The son ran away. The father set off to find him. And he searched. I mean, he searched for months to find his son. And he couldn't do it. So finally, in a last desperate effort to find his son, the father put an ad in the newspaper in Madrid. The ad read this: Dear Paco, meet me in front of this newspaper office at noon on Saturday. All is forgiven. I love you, your father. On Saturday, 800 Pacos showed up looking for forgiveness and love from their fathers. Okay, in all seriousness, and just for a moment, who's sick? We all are. We all are. That's only part of the story. The rest of it is that Jesus' grace is sufficient to cover a multitude of sins. It's sufficient. It's enough. It is enough. What I prayed this morning is that not you would glean the wisdom of Solomon, because there's so much to glean. I'm only touching on it. I'm only touching on it. The guy has a lot to say to his son about the kind of wife that you look for, the kinds of decisions that you avoid. By the way, you think he got that from somewhere in his life? Because I'm thinking, yeah. But notice in all of it, what is he trying to do? It's not just that you have wisdom, it's that you have God. It's that you have God, the source of wisdom. That's what I've prayed for you this week.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.